Are you a wine importer, restaurant wine director, or retailer working with direct import? Probably you are because you're listening to the show right now. Well, do you have also a strong interest in expanding your selection of Italian wines? If so, I have a pretty awesome opportunity for you. I'll be leading a group of buyers to Verona in Italy for the inaugural edition of Wine to Wine, a new forum for buyers to taste directly with producers. Wine to Wine has been developed by Vinitaly, which is the largest trade show in the world. You've probably heard about it. And this is a new chance to meet with producers face to face in Italy, make some great connections in a little bit of a smaller format. All Drink to That is a podcast partner with Wine to Wine, and we're really excited about it. You have the opportunity to join me at Wine to Wine in Italy on December 2nd and 3rd of this year, because a travel and lodging stipend is being made available to buyers. If you are someone who wants to grow your Italian wine portfolio, this is an excellent chance to do so. To apply to join me and the many excellent producers at Wine to Wine, you should send an email to media@vinitalytour.com. That's media@vinitalytour.com. So VINITALY. TOUR.com. You want to include in that email a short bio that covers your work responsibilities and also a paragraph discussing your interest in Italian wine. If the Vinitaly folks like what they see, they'll follow back up with you for some more information. This is a pretty spectacular chance to go to Italy and taste with producers at no cost to you, but you need to have a strong interest in Italian wine and you need to be a buyer. If that's you, email media@vinitalytour.com with your details to get started, and I might just see you in Verona. All Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
I'm Michelle Basilia, Wine Director of Blue Hill, New York City.
Lee Campbell from Diner in Brooklyn.
This is Sharon Severins from Amonti Vino in Montclair, New Jersey.
Patrick Cappiello, Rebel and Pearl and Ash.
Ian Doran from the Wine Library.
Jeremy Noy, Morel Fine Wine Retail and Wine Bar at Rockefeller Center.
These tri-state buyers all know that 750 is a one-stop resource for the beverage alcohol trade. Search across distributor portfolios, see trade tastings, and easily connect with your sales rep. It's free and easy to sign up. Robert Bohr on the show. Hello, sir. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for having me.
Nice to see you.
Very happy to be here.
You're from Jersey originally?
Yes, grew up in New Jersey, born in Rhode Island, grew up in New Jersey.
What was your grandfather like?
Oh, my grandfather's the most amazing person I know. He's like the embodiment of the American dream. Son of immigrants, grew up working as a welder, went into the service, into the Marines, World War II, fought in on Iwo Jima, amazing guy, came back, went to school to be an engineer. Raised five kids well, went to church every Sunday and every day during Lent, and raised, gosh, I don't know, 10 grandchildren. Just an amazing human being. Probably the most important, most important person that I look to.
What was he like to you?
Oh, it's great. He's still alive. He's 91. He had just turned 91. My mom has four sisters, and she's the eldest, and so. When she had her first child, which was my older sister, it was a continuous string of women. And so by the time I came along, he was pretty happy to have a grandson. And so my mom gave this toast at our wedding, where I got gifts when I was young that maybe seemed inappropriate to most people, like bayonets and walkie-talkies and et cetera. But they were for me great. And I was the benefit factor of a lot of just a lot of love, a lot of generosity, a lot of great life lessons. I learned walking in Passaic, where he was from. We walking down the street, and he saw a guy sweeping the street, and he looked at the guy, and he looked at me, and he said, "You see that guy sweeping the street? That guy knows more about sweeping the street than you'll ever know. So don't ever think that you're better than anybody." And it's something that it sticks with you when those life lessons are important. I think we all need to hear a little bit more of that. Great guy.
Who were you as a kid? I mean,
I was a clown. I was you know, my older sister was or is an overachiever, and so I felt like I had to get attention by being the smartass, the one who acted out in school. But at home, my parents were, I wouldn't say strict, but they had a strong belief that children had a place in the family that was to be respectful to elders. And so my mom said all the time that you can act like an animal outside of the house with your friends, I don't care, but when you're in the house or when people are over, you have company manners. And my mom would use that all the time, company manners. And so when I was around my friends' parents, they thought I was a wonderful, well-behaved child, and I was actually an asshole most of the time. And but I really am grateful for my parents instilling that lesson of being respectful to your elders and giving credit for people to people for which they've done, which you may or may not understand at the time, but it's kind of a corollary to what my grandfather was saying about the street sweeper, was that you may not know what these people are doing or how they got there, who they are or not, but they're older than you and they've had different experiences and they've had more life experience than you have. So you have to give them some sort of respect, some deference. Probably a lot of people listening probably think I should continue that lesson these days, but
I can see that playing out in restaurants though. Come on. I mean, especially if you're waiting tables in Jersey, where it's probably going to be a local suburban clientele, right?
Very important. And I think when I was young, very young, in grade school, my relatives would come over. We have a pretty large family, and we all live very close to each other, so there would be a lot of family members over. And as soon as someone would come in, I would get up from my seat, and I would go, and I would take their coat, or I would ask them if they would want something to drink. I knew everyone in my family's drinks. You know, my dad's mother would drink a highball, and my grandfather would drink a scotch and soda, and my grandmother we drink white wine and with ice, and usually we had a big jug of white wine that had been in the wine cabinet or liquor cabinet since the last time she was there, you know, not refrigerated, maybe a cork in it, but probably not, or a screw top. And
that's why you don't like orange wine, right there.
Exactly, right there.
From the beginning.
And that notion of serving the people that came to our house and just, again, getting up for people, giving them your seat, thinking of yourself second, as a child, gives you a little bit of an understanding of what is necessary to be a good person in a restaurant, a good server, in short. And I think in order to be a good sommelier, you have to be a good server.
So why did you pick restaurants instead of like mechanic or, you know, something hands-on?
Yeah, it's hard, you know, because that's what everyone in my family really does. They're it's a great amalgam of blue-collar workers, from plumbers, electricians, telephone guys, carpenters. Weekends around the house were always some sort of do-it-yourself project, either at our house or one of our relatives, and it was kind of all hands on deck. And so when I started working in restaurants, it was really an economic necessity. My mom said, you know, we had a fixed allowance for clothes for the year, and it was not very much. And she, you know, we integrated with the school across the highway, which was a much more affluent community, and everyone was wearing Ralph Lauren shirts. His polo shirts were big in the 80s, and I wanted one. And my mom said, well, I'm not buying an $80 shirt. You're out of your mind.
Right.
If you think that that's what you want to do with your money. I had a paper to route at that time. She said, I don't make $80, you know, throwing newspapers before school in the morning. And so I got a job working as a dishwasher and a busboy at this local Italian restaurant called Villa Molise. And I was a small family, and the two brothers were the cooks. The mother was the maitre d', host, manager, owner, and they had two daughters. And it was a family-run place, and it taught me a lot. It taught me a lot about how to listen, how to get out of the way, how to avoid getting hot pans thrown at you, but more than anything, how to make people happy.
But you felt that they liked you, the family.
Yeah, I think they did. I spent a lot of time there. I really enjoyed it, and I learned a lot. I learned a lot about, how, you know, it was, as you said, it was a small town, and you saw a lot of the same people over and again, and a lot of them were parents of my friends from across the highway, the kids who I, recent new friends in a way, and they were impressed that one of their sons or daughters, classmates, was working nights. And
like they would go home to their kids and be like, why don't you be like Robert? See, he's taking responsibility for his life. He doesn't ask for anything.
They would be, and then the kids would say, yeah, you should see him in school. Not a great student at the time. But it was, I learned a lot about, again, I think the thing about hospitality is more than the mechanics of service. It's make really wanting, having a genuine desire to make people feel welcome and feel good and happy about being in your restaurant. So I learned that at an early age.
And you worked for Danny Meyer kind of early in the career, right?
Early in the career. After I worked for two restaurants in New Jersey while I actually commuted while I was at NYU back to New Jersey because I couldn't get a job in New York City. Because
difficult.
That catch 22 of New York experience, right? You don't have it, but you can't get it. But I worked, so it was I would take the bus into New Jersey to work at this restaurant called Ecola. And I lived in Brooklyn while I was attending NYU. So it was a legitimate commute, but it was the only job I could really continue doing.
There was less restaurants back then. They weren't always looking for...
Yeah, it was really competitive. And there were a lot of pros, I'd say. You know, even though the kind of the métier of restaurant wasn't what it was then, the people who were doing it were committed. I mean, they it was their livelihood. They were acting on the side, or they were an artist, or they were doing something. But when they were at work, they were solid. And so there wasn't a lot of room for a kid who had ambition to go to law school and work part-time while going to school. And I luckily got a break by chance after I worked briefly at Tavern on the Green. It was very, very brief. It was 2 months, but the...
Broke into the union thing pretty nice, did it?
Exactly. The union thing was a little tough for me. When I was told I couldn't help the back waiters reset a table because that wasn't my job, I had a hard time with that. But the service director there said, you know, you really should go work where someone's going to appreciate what you do. And he just come from Gramercy Tavern. He put in a call.
That was nice, huh? That was a nice thing.
Huge, huge, huge. It changed my life, truly. One of the seminal moments of how I'm sitting in front of you was someone seeing that I actually cared and someone taking the time and consideration to think, where can this person succeed or excel? And he put in a call to a guy named Chris Russell, who was a captain at Gramercy, and Chris took me under his wing after I can't believe I actually was hired because I was incredibly obnoxious. And they have a test of, they did, I don't know if they still do, a multi-page test where you rate yourself on different skills and it's long form and then there's ratings 1 to 10.
Giving yourself 11s down the board?
No, it's like, it was great. It's actually really smart because it's like longhand, so you're writing a lot of answers. In the back, it's rate yourself on a scale of 1 to 10 with plate carrying and wine knowledge and cocktail knowledge and beer knowledge and blah, blah, blah. And then the last one is penmanship. So it's like a great, it lets them know how full of shit you are on the plate carrying techniques. But I think I wrote wine knowledge of like a 6 because, you know, I was in college and I spent about 2.5 months in France. And I'd spent, so while we were there, it was great. NYU has these incredible programs where you could take day trips to all these different places like the Loire and da, da, da. And so, and there's a lot of culture in addition to the language part of the NYU that you would learn a lot about the culture of French wine and how important it is, etc. And so we read a lot of books. We took some day trips. We went down to Avignon and it was just really great. And after the class in Paris, I went down to Lyon and stayed with a friend for a couple of weeks and we kind of tooled around and I was really interested in it. And it was funny. This was 1996. Yeah. And I was studying. I was really studying about wine at this point. And the service director started asking me questions like, what does Blanc de Blanc mean? I said, you know, I just told you I was just in France. It means white from white. And it means, well, champagne made from Chardonnay. And he gave me another question that was kind of like a layup. And I was like, oh my God, I kind of rolled my eyes. He's like, all right, well, what are the grapes that comprise Amarone? I went, oh shit, I don't know that. He goes, you shouldn't know that. Okay, moving along. And I couldn't believe that after being that much of an asshole, I still got the job. But they put me in my place pretty quickly. It was a very competitive environment. All the front waiters were pros. The captains were mythical. There was very little on-site management. Everyone managed themselves, and there was a lot of...
This is about a year after it opened, right?
They opened in 94. I think it went through a little change in 95. Some of the opening team kind of came and left. And this was... Paul Greco was still a captain at the time and a complete prick, but really on it. He was the first person I ever heard say, I'm not doing this to do something else. I'm in it. This is my career. First person I ever heard say that. It was unbelievable. because I was going to school full time and I really had ambitions to go to law school. I really believed that there was something in law, in public service, in government, in judiciary. I really was really
helping people back in the communities.
Kinda. I really believed, you know, even this was still 1996, 97. I thought that the things that we're seeing now with marriage equality was something that I really felt strongly about back then. I thought I was going to work for Lambda Legal Defense or the ACLU or something like that. And so to hear someone who was really, Paul knew everything. He was super on it to say, this is my career. This is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. It gave me pause. And I have to say the working for, and I use that preposition correctly, Danny Meyer, gave you the belief that it is a noble profession. Maybe not noble is the right word, but a legitimate profession, a profession that should engender some respect amongst your peers and ideally your parents.
You wouldn't have to apologize for this profession.
I thought up until then, yes. And seeing how a person of so many talents like Danny comported himself, really thought, wow, that's a great role model. I think a lot of people, if they met him, wouldn't think less of me for working in his restaurant. And they definitely gave me some consideration. I felt like I was studying more to be a part of the team at Gramercy than I was to finish my undergrad at NYU.
What was the wine side like?
Wine was exciting because Gramercy had a dynamic wine program and it didn't focus on regions as much as kind of characteristics of wine. So it had full-bodied reds or spicy reds or all these things that I think are kind of silly. At the time, I thought it was a cool thing to talk about. And so we tasted wine every service before in our meeting. A lot of the times, once Paul came on, we did it blind. And it was a conversation. He called on people and said, what do you get out of this wine? What do you think it is? What would you serve it with? And where does it rank in the scale of quality? How much do you think this should cost? And you were on the spot and you had to be smart. And in order to go from waiter to captain, you had to know the wine program in and out. And so I would, you know, in between doubles, I would go to the Barnes & Noble on Union Square and I'd read like the books that I see on your shelf over here. All, you know, and I couldn't afford the books. So I would read the books, put them back on the shelf with a bookmark in it and go back the next day and read, you know, Wines of the Rhone Valley or Parker's Bordeaux or Cote d'Or and all these books. So I could hold my own in these conversations. I had a student's mind still at the time. So I felt I was able to absorb a lot of information.
But you also felt you were being challenged. Like you had to step up.
Oh, unbelievable. On everything. On food, Tom Klicky would come and say, all right. And he would call on whoever and say, and you'd stand up and you'd say, all right, sell me the sweetbread dish. And you knew what the sous-vide was made of and how long it was cooked and that the sweetbreads were poached. I can tell you everything on that menu today. This was 19 years ago. Because of the training that you had and that you were called upon to stand up, talk about the food, sell it, then give three wine pairings. What is the classic pairing? What is your favorite? And what is something completely off the reservation? And you had to be fluent with sherry and port and Madeira and sweet wine and beer. And it was unbelievable. It was incredible education. Really great. The end of the night, this was back when you still got cash tips and you could get your cash at the night if you stuck around. Someone did the money. Sit around, you have a shift drink. Still had shift drinks. It was amazing. And you got to raid Claudia Fleming's unbelievable dessert cart because she made all the desserts every day. And so whatever was left over was fair game because it was going to go in the trash. So you'd drink a couple glasses of wine, you'd eat 5,000 calories of sugar, and you'd get your cash, and then you were in New York City. And
set loose.
It was dangerous. There were some bad corner bistro nights and all this crazy fun stuff. And some people I worked with back then are still friends. Paul Greco being, you know, chief among them. I still see him. I was there when he met his then future wife, Katie. She was an intern from Cornell. And people are really incredible people.
And you had a connection with Paul, and he kind of let you help with the wines a little bit.
Well, no. He was, there were kind of people who were more interested in wine than food, and I was one of the people more interested in wine. And so inevitably, there were other captains who were really, really good at other things, cheese or something like that, and I would ask for their help with that. And if they were busy, they would say, hey, can you decant a bottle of blah, blah, blah for me? And I would,
because there's no sommelier.
There's no sommelier on the floor. All the captains did all the wine service. It was great. So Paul, when he was a waiter, he He was insufferable. He wouldn't even allow a manager in his station. And then he became the assistant general manager and wine director. And he would come into your station and start telling you something. You'd be like, Paul, get the fuck out of my station. Who are you? Like, remember a month ago how much of an asshole you were? I'm that asshole now. Get out of my station. And he hated it because he's super controlling. But he's right. Over time, he created a staff more and more that was less challenging, I think, than the people who were his peers and had to be, you know, work under him. We challenged him. We and Richard Luftig, who worked there at the time, would just, I felt so bad for Paul. Actually, I didn't at the time, but now I do, because we would torture him. We'd be like, Paul, this wine's corked. And, you know, we would just be like throwing bombs at him every time he'd serve us wine. And we were just jerks. But what he did do is he did do a lot of interactive wine classes for guests. And so he would have like Saturday lunch in the dining room, which was normally closed, French wine class or Italian wine class or something like that, to go with cheeses. And even though I hate cheese, I really want to learn about wine. So Richard and I would be kind of his assistants during those days. And it was great. I learned a lot with him. And, you know, Paul has a long family history of restaurants, so he brought a lot to the table.
Paul was from an Italian restaurant, and Richard really liked Italian wine.
Richard really and knew, and still to this day, one of the most knowledgeable persons in Italian wine, probably wine in general. He was a big student. But yeah, he was really passionate about Italian wine. And when we left Gramercy, we had a brief stint working together at Oriole before we went into the Italian wine world, where I went to Babbo and he went to Falidia. But we, you know, we tasted Sassicaia for the first time at Gramercy, or Quinterno, or Paul opened anything on the wine list was fair game. Anything, no matter how expensive it was. If he got a 6-bottle allocation, he thought it was important for people to know what Sassicaia was. He thought it was an important wine. I remember first tasting Araujo or Chave. It was just wines that at the time were things you read in books, and now it was something that was in front of you, and it was a great opportunity. So yeah, a lot of our good and our bad habits were formed there.
You went to Babbo after Oriole.
Yeah, and everyone thought I was crazy. But I left Gramercy as a captain, was a food runner at Oriole, and I was making a ton of money, but it was blood money. It was like 11 shifts, up and down stairs. It was treacherous, as Richard would say, running food up and down stairs that were recently mopped with like an oily mop. It was just the craziest thing. That's where thankfully I got to meet Ned Benedict and watched him turn a few key phrases with guests and servers, which I'll never forget. And then one of the captains from Gramercy Tavern, James Danos, was the general manager, recently hired general manager at Babbo. And he called me. He was a very strong personality. And he's like, I need you down here. And I was like, James, I don't know anything about Italian wine. He's like, you'll figure it out. You used to do all the wine service at my station. You got to come down. He was screaming at me. So I left this very lucrative. I mean, remember, Oriole, 1998, top of the Zagat, 3 stars, fancy, full to capacity. And everyone said, oh, I'm leaving. I'm going to work in this restaurant downtown called Babbo. And they're like, you're going to go to a restaurant called Babbo? What are you, crazy? You're at Oriole, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. But a lot of the great captains from Gramercy left and went to Babbo. Some of the people I really respected and liked working with.
That guy made a few phone calls.
He definitely padded the team. And I worked there, and I really learned on the job. I devoured books on Italian wine. I took a trip to Italy, but really I learned by tasting, by meeting reps, by talking to winemakers. It was unbelievable. And it was the restaurant that they didn't expect. Mario and Joe didn't expect the restaurant to become what it quickly became, I don't think.
What do you think drew so many people down there?
Mario had a small following at Po, and it was a great, fun, busy restaurant, but his food was exciting. And he was turning people on to things that they never thought they could or should eat, calves brains or sweetbreads and lamb's tongue and all these crazy things, but with real aplomb. I have to say, he's one of the... I have so much admiration for that guy's technical ability. Mario's a real... Anyone thinks that he's just glitz and TV, they're fooling themselves. The guy's a real talent. He's an incredible cook. I watched him kick people off their station and just crush service. He's unbelievable. Very nimble for a big guy. Really, really, really gifted on the stoves. And he has a razor sharp understanding of all things food, all things Italian. You had 3 strikes. If you mispronounced something, if you didn't know the derivation or how something was cooked at meetings. He would call on you and he would ask you blah, 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 blah. And if you didn't know what cavatelli was or where it came from or what's this component or what's the key thing to it, what is harissa, the fiery peppery condiment from Tunisia? Verbatim, Mario. You're welcome. Word for word, he demanded your attention. And he got it from guests, food writers. From minute one, he was an incredible media attraction because that's a rare combination of real powerful intellect, incredible technical ability and charm, and not giving a shit, playing really loud rock and roll music despite people complaining.
And it got 3 stars.
And it got 3 stars.
Out of the gate.
Unbelievable. I still remember going to Balthazar for the 3-star party, and one, I had never been to Balthazar before because it was still relatively new, and it was a party. That's the other thing. You work hard and you play hard there. You could drink till 5 in the morning, you know, on the stoop outside Babbo, and you wouldn't be looked down upon.
But that trip to Italy, I mean, that was the Alfredo Corrado trip?
It's where Luca Corrado's father, Alfredo, invited Richard and he brought me along to meet all of his contemporaries. Roberto Quintana's father, Giovanni, and Bruno Giacosa, and Pepe Rinaldi, and an amazing day. Where neither of us spoke Italian and none of these guys spoke English. And we had a great day where I think I learned more in a single day about Italian wine than I had in the 3 years learning about it before. So great. I'll never forget that day.
So at Babbo, are you starting to think, I mean, am I going to open my own place one day? I mean, what was going on in your mind at that time?
Yeah, so I was at Babbo while I was applying to law school. So I was fortunate to be mentored by the then dean of NYU Law, John Sexton, who then became president.
He's kind of a famous guy, right?
He's the smartest guy I've ever met. He's one of the most successful presidents in American universities, and now globally. He's expanded the NYU campus around the globe. He's an incredible human being. And he took a shine to me when I was an undergrad taking his freshman honors seminar on the Supreme Court and the religious clauses of the Constitution, which is unbelievable because he was a Jesuit, married a Jewish woman. He has his PhD in theology and has his, you know, JD from Harvard Law and can recite everything, but he has this texture and the class was amazing. And after class, he would invite me back to his house to continue talking about the class and my future and what I wanted to do. He worked for the ACLU, so he gave me a lot of information about it. And he'd be like, I got to go tuck my daughter into bed, but we can have some coffee and we can continue the conversation. He was incredibly generous with his time. And when I graduated, I asked him to write letters of recommendation for law schools, which he did. And I'm assuming on really the power of his words that I get into law school. And he lived in the building next to Babbo, and he came in. He doesn't drink wine, sadly, so I was never really ever able to show him what I learned. But he saw how much I loved working in the restaurant business, how much joy I got out of being there, even though it was a very difficult experience. The hours were long and the job was very hard. He saw it, and he gave me advice that I would never take from any other person, I don't think, was that you should continue to do what you love until you no longer love it, and that I always had a place at NYU Law School as long as he was involved. And he told me he didn't go to law school until he was 34. This is powerful when you're a 24-year-old person who graduated from college, which was not expected of me. I was not a very good student up until college. And I'm on the precipice of going to one of the great American law universities. And to be told not to continue working in the restaurant business is 180 degrees from everything you think is the advice a smart, experienced educator would give. Again, one of those seminal moments in your life.
That sounds to me like another strong father figure in the mix. Danny, Mario, Sexton.
Sure. Sexton. So flash forward to my engagement, post-engagement with John. And sadly, it's at his wife's funeral service, but this is a force of what a man John is, and he sees Jordan's engagement ring and says, oh, why are we talking about all this other stuff? We should be celebrating your obvious engagement. And he turned the moment away from the grief we felt and the mourning we were in with him to the celebration of us. And Jordan had heard me talk about John at length, but didn't have the same connection with him in the number of times. But right after that, she said, do you think John would marry us? And I thought, I really have found the right one, you know, that she knew how much this man meant to me. And so John, in the end, was the officiant of our wedding in Aspen. He was, he, and to this day, is still a very close friend and person I really respect.
So you took his advice and you stayed in restaurants?
Kind of stayed on the Italian wine thing for a while. And I was, by chance, you know, and, there, and again, one of the reasons why I'm here is because of that decision or that, you know, that kind of serendipity that I started in Italian wine and not in French wine. So I started in French wine at that time. If you had a sommelier in your restaurant, you were a French restaurant. You were a French sommelier almost assuredly, and you're probably in Midtown. And there weren't a lot of them. I was fortunate by just by happenstance to start in Italian wine, and there weren't that many people really focused in Italian wine at the time. So I kind of got to carve out a little specialty, a little niche in the business that if I hadn't, I would be competing with people who had a competitive advantage over me that I where I wouldn't have been able to shine. And I did Italian wine for a few years exclusively until I was asked by Jean-Luc Ledoux to be his assistant at Danielle, and we would trade knowledge. He wanted to learn more about Italian wine, and I wanted to learn more about French wine.
And he probably needed the help. He was probably doing a lot of covers.
Yeah. First night, training night, 340 covers. We divided the dining room. He's like, you take station 456, I'll take 1, 2, 3, and we'll split the lounge. And I said, I don't know what station 456 is.
Right,
he's like, it's
right.
The left side of the dining room. I was like, great. Unbelievable. I've never worked. Yeah, that was crazy. And at the highest level. But really amazing.
And hitting it at that time.
Crushing it. And I mean, now there's a great team of four sommeliers. Back then, it was Jean-Luc and he had two part-time assistants. I was one of them. And unbelievable. I remember there was a whole page of Rumier that he'd just gotten from Chateau Estates. And the prices, massive markups, but still really small prices relative to the quality of the wines. And I thought to myself, I was one of the sommeliers that you hate when you're a wine director that is going to focus on one thing and just crush the whole wine page. So I did that. I learned about Burgundy through Christophe Rumier's eyes. And when I went to Burgundy for the first time, that's the first person, only person I visited.
What was that visit like?
You know, Burgundy back then was, this was 2001. You know, there were maybe five sommeliers going there frequently. It was not what it is. It's not the amusement park.
You're like, oh, it's now. Ned.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, Daniel Jonas is here.
Right. It's there's
Raj.
No, yeah, exactly. There were people weren't, also, restaurants didn't give you travel expense budgets or there weren't junkets like there are today. If you were traveling in Europe, you were doing it on your own dime. I happened to be there for a friend's wedding and, you know, I drove down. Saw Christophe, and Jean-Luc made the appointment for me because he knew how much I loved his wines, and I'd been selling them. And
tried to get a bigger allocation from him.
Exactly.
While you're there, talk to him.
Shake him down. And Christophe spent the whole day. We walked through all the vineyards. I still have some pictures of that day. You know, the different soil types in Bunmar, and something that you just think is the craziest thing, that there's within an appellation like of Bunmar, there are completely diverse soils, and how he vinifies them separately, and then you taste them separately, then you taste the blend of the two, is just all these amazing things. And one day where that's really when you can fall in love. And that's another one of those days where it just flipped the switch. And, you know, people who don't know me well listening to this will think of me as Burgundy first, but it was certainly Italian wine that got me to Burgundy. And I think if I hadn't had the challenge of trying to learn about Italian wine pre-internet, pre-like, Guild of Quartermaster Sommeliers, whatever website where you can like learn about everything and like with, you know, sitting in your chair.
It was you and Burton Anderson.
Exactly.
Night
right.
After night.
That's it. And not even the Wine Atlas of Italy. You know, that was the most recent book published on Italy in 1990. You had to go back to his like 1978 Vino book. And you're reading 1998, you're reading a 20-year out of date book. And that's the best shit you got. You know, it's crazy that that's where you had to learn. But having to go through the rigors of learning about Italian wine with very little information, there's so much information about Burgundy out there, but there's a lot of nuance. And when you start looking to Italian wine with a million different varietals that you can't pronounce, and you go to something really easy like Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, but all of the climats are so difficult, you're just exchanging complexity. So it was a fun kind of challenge to take on Burgundy and try to really to learn about it. And I'm still trying.
But it became kind of a signature thing for you, as you referred to.
Yeah, for sure. Because I learned a lot about Burgundy. I met Roy Welland.
How'd you and Roy meet?
I met Roy in passing at Nick and Tony's in East Hampton, where I, from 1999 to like 2010 or something, I did the wine list. But I worked on the floor from 99 to 04, every summer, Fridays and Saturday nights, where I met some of the most unbelievable people, the craziest stories.
This is go time in the Hamptons.
Go times in the Hamptons, Friday, Saturday. July 4th to Labor Day, full contact. And I met my first and closest now private client there. I met a lot of future investors of our restaurants and our other deals there. And I met Roy there. But it was only in passing. He became friends with Jonathan Waxman, who was opening Washington Park. And I had briefly worked with Jonathan at Colina in between working at Babbo and Lupa. And Jonathan said, you got to meet this guy, you know, blah, blah, blah. So we went to dinner at Danielle. And
Jonathan likes wine.
Jonathan likes wine. Jonathan likes all things nice. He's got good taste. He's been around the block.
And Roy was his investor.
Roy was an investor and really keen about wine and making a ton of money. He was an options trader before options software existed, and he could do all the calculations in his head. He's a brilliant mathematician and loved
and
wine.
He thought wine was undervalued. He was looking at it and was like, well, are you serious with this?
Exactly.
These prices?
He was and is a gambler, like in the best sense of that word, in that he would look at a trade and say, if the trade's good for one, it's good for 100. And so when we were offered, I don't know, 96 Dom Perignon Rosé, and I would say, oh, we should buy like a couple of cases. He's like, well, how much can you get? I said, oh, I don't know. Can you get 100 cases? I would, maybe 50. He's like, all right, get 50 cases. And two pallets of Dom Perignon Rosé would arrive. And you would think to yourself, this is the craziest thing. Or not, 71 Latache at auction. There are five cases in a parcel. You bought the first one. He goes, well, if you bought the first, why aren't you buying the other four? And you would think, well, because I don't have $100,000, Roy. That's why I don't buy all five. And he would just, oh, no, buy all five.
Stop thinking like a poor person, Robert.
Exactly. And as a result, we started to build what became the wine collection at Crew. And bought a lot of wine overseas, a lot of wine at auction. And we went from, I met Roy at 5,000 bottles of wine. When we closed Crew, I think we had 165,000 after selling a lot of wine, drinking mostly a lot of wine.
And Richard Luftick was there and John Silver was there.
You know, that was the best thing about, I think that's the best thing about our business, about our career, is that over time, you do it long enough, you get to spend time with, and a lot of time, you know, you spend a lot more time with your coworkers than you do with your family in the restaurant business. And so I got to spend three lifetimes sitting next to John Slover in the office at Crew. One of the best floor sommeliers I've ever seen. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Raj Veda and Michel Couvreur, the guy who can assess where a table wants to go with wine in 8-10 seconds. He knows before that guy puts the wine list down what he is going to aspire to order. And he is unbelievable. A real pro. And in every level of pro. He could be the maitre d', he could be the sous chef, he could be the sommelier, and he could be the captain. In fact, he could run a restaurant he could do everything. If he had one table, he could do everything. He's an amazing, amazing guy to watch work. Humbling to be the, you know, quote unquote, like boss of a guy like Michel Couvreur.
Pretty good taster.
Great. Everything about Michel, it's like unbelievable. An ability to devour work, tireless. But more than anything, his read, his gut instinct about a table is otherworldly. And it's why when you see a guy like that not succeed in some parts of the wine world, you start to question the veracity of that test, right? And, you know, obviously I'm talking about Michel tried and tried and tried again to pass the MS and he never succeeded. And God, I thought to myself, this guy can't pass. I don't know how anyone does. He's the best I've seen. I've seen a lot of great guys and women. It's just unreal. So, yeah, so that was hard. It's hard to see someone like that. And a bunch of friends, I can list a bunch of people who I saw go through that trial and that are great. Scott Tyree, one of the best sommeliers that I'd ever seen work in Chicago, never passed. And I thought, wow, this is not for me. But I have a lot of respect for the court. I have a lot of respect for the people who are going through it. And then the people who pass, they've committed a ton of their time. I can tell you firsthand, I am a court battered spouse. My wife has been going through the court for a few years now, and I don't envy anyone who's taking on that role. It's a real commitment, and I tip my hat to the people who are engaged in that. It's just not for me. If you think back to who were the superstar sommeliers of the 90s in New York City, Michel, Jean-Luc Ledoux, Daniel Jonas, Tim Kopeck, bunch of these guys, and back then it was guys, you know, truthfully, they were Joe Nace. I'm just trying to think of who these people were, right? And huge people in the industry. None of them passed any tests. They were great. And maybe would they have been better at their job? Possibly. Yeah, maybe.
They passed the test at the table, right?
I never thought at the time that that's the way to be a sommelier. And that wasn't a part of the New York culture in the 90s. Now it really is. And I think people like, you know, John Reagan and Laura Manick and people that are bringing a lot of people through the court and hiring a lot of court members in their programs is only kind of building a better court of master sommeliers. I think it's actually gotten a lot better, a lot richer than when you and I started in the wine business in New York.
The person who gives out the job gets to determine how important it is. You know what I mean?
For sure. For sure. And that's fair, right? Though, you know, Grant at Charlie Bird is passes advanced. You know, Arvid is taking the best sommelier in the world competition next year. And I imagine if he takes the MS test, he'll do fine. He's a real scholar. So it's not like I wouldn't hire MS guys. I would for sure. Cause there's some,
you'd like a little street smarts too. You'd like a little attention to things.
Yeah. I don't think they're mutually exclusive, but I think that if I had to choose between street smarts and book smarts, I'd take street smarts in almost everything every day.
Cause you came up that way, right?
I came up that way. Yeah. Maybe that's what it is. You know, you covet what you know, and I know learning wine from books, but I really know wine from trial by fire, by being at the table and like trying to describe something that is completely foreign to someone. Try to describe Valentini Trebbiano to a person who only drinks California Chardonnay. And that's the closest thing that you're going to be able to get on and that's an important skill. And then unfortunately, that's a skill that can't be tested. You can't administer an exam where that skill is really, I think that table side skill is the most important thing, much more important than wine knowledge, much more important than decanting skills. And not that anything isn't important, but the connection with a guest is the most important thing.
So Washington Park becomes Crew, and in terms of table side, I mean, Robert Bohr was eating it up, bro. I remember watching you tableside at Crew. Man, you loved being tableside.
I love it. I still love it. I was fortunate, and I don't want anyone to think that I don't value the opportunity there or anywhere. I really felt Roy had given me an opportunity to build the wine program of my dreams. What did I care about? What did I want to buy? What did I want to defend? What did I want to highlight? And we had the ability to have everything.
Why so much trust at a young age for you? I mean, Roy is not young, but I mean, why you?
You know, I wish I could tell you, but I think what he taught me is what I'm trying to live now. And that is find good people that you trust, give them a chance and empower them and be generous. And Roy was so generous with me. And as I have a little bit more to offer, I try to bring other people in and share my good fortune with them. Because
I think you've always been good about that. That's been part of your success, I think, is you built a crew and you looked out for them.
Yeah, I try because someone looked after me. And I think that Roy giving me that trust and a lot of people giving me a lot of opportunity that maybe on paper I shouldn't have gotten, or I didn't get there by birthright or class, but I got there.
I mean, you're not French, right? You don't have the accent. You don't necessarily have the look. You're Jersey.
Jersey. I grew up in a very modest blue-collar way, and no one really drinks wine. My parents don't drink wine, and we didn't come part of the culture, a dining culture. But so when Roy gave me this opportunity, we were able to really learn about wine, great wine, you know, wines you read about, vintages you read about. I wonder what 29 Latour tastes like versus 59 Latour. Well, let's open them and let's talk about it. And he was all for it. You know, the speed bump wine for Roy was 71 Latache before he would drink a magnum of 85 Jaillet Chasseau. I'm not just like name dropping. That you can ask Ned, that happened many times. He'd be like, oh, the Jaillet is closed. We need a speed bump. And I knew speed bump meant go get a bottle of 71 Latache. And that's how Roy, and he invited sommeliers and chefs and people who loved wine over, and just, he was so generous with so many people. And he would host wine dinners in the private room, first at Washington Park and then at Crewe. If winemakers were in town, he would say, let's organize a dinner and we'll open anything you want that you think they want to try. And it was a crazy time. So then it became like a vicious cycle. There would be a 49 J.G. Prue Malchelet at auction. I would love to try that wine. I imagine Jean-Marc Rouleau would love to try that wine the next time he's in town, blah, blah, blah. And as a result, the opportunity to taste wine was insane, just insane, inconceivable by today's standards.
And it also seems like at that time, or maybe before, you really said, I'm going to start developing relationships with growers and producers.
Yeah, I mean, if it's a luxurious position to be in, if you can get it, take it. And having a platform where you had a partner, a boss, a benefactor who really encouraged that, who really asked you to invite these people in and throw a great party for them at his expense. I am where I am today in the wine world because of Roy.
And where do you think that was coming from? I mean, Roy was an orphan.
Yeah, not an orphan. No, he left home early because I don't know exactly why, but he left and he literally lived on the streets in the real sense of the word. He learned how to take care of himself. He's a very, very quick study. He's an incredibly sharp mind, but he can assess probability better than anyone. So he was able to really play cards for a living and did well. And
that he launched. Played professional bridge.
He still plays professional bridge, but before professional bridge, he played backgammon for money or three card Monty kind of stuff. I mean, like crazy. Well, he's really an incredible guy that way. So someone who didn't have a lot of trust in others had so much trust in me in this world. So yeah, again, Roy's the best man of our wedding, you know? So there's a picture of me with John Sexton, my grandfather, Roy, and my dad. And it was, that's it.
I think the relationship with Jordan was really important to you from the minute it happened, right?
Yeah, I met Jordan April of 2003. I remember because it was at WD-50. She was a host and working in, she just finished college and was working to be a food writer. And she was working at WD-50. And I worked for Wiley Dufresne briefly at 71 Clinton. I took a little sabbatical from Restaurant Daniel to go down and work with him to see if I could, we had the chemistry where we could open a restaurant together. We had been friends through his girlfriend at the time, Liz Ouellette. And I loved working with Wiley. And so the idea was I was going to open WD-50 with him. Delays kind of didn't allow it to happen just because there's too many time delays and I needed a job. But we kept in touch and I learned so much from Wiley. I learned the guy spends weeks preparing for a dish. He makes every permutation and combination possible. He puts them together, tastes them all, and then decides which is the best of them. And along the way, he asks your opinion and what do you think wine's going to go with it? Where does wine fit in this relationship with the dish? Is this too strong for this kind of wine? He's super curious about the impact of food and wine together. I loved that time that I spent with him. So I really thought I could open WD-50. Anyway.
Jordan, he puts in a lot of effort to make it look easy, which is kind of your style, right?
Yeah.
That's the Robert signature, I think. I mean, I've seen you plan a wine dinner. I know how you do it.
I think, you know, there are people who have natural abilities, and then there are people who work really hard. And I work really hard.
And maybe that was a connection with Roy as well.
Yeah, maybe. You know, humble roots. You know, because you're around some people who are just encyclopedic knowledge, who have God-given palates, like really impeccable tasting ability. And you're around them. It's hard to not be awed by that, right? And if you don't have that stuff, you have to have something else to play in this game in New York. And so for me, it was always real hard work, a lot of time. And so Wiley did that You know, I never got to watch Danielle create a dish, but I got to watch Wiley create a dish, and I couldn't be more impressed. And I wanted to work with him, but luckily our friendship put me in a position to meet Jordan, who was working there, and I went there before it opened. We were talking about a book that she was reading or something. I was definitely not.
You weren't listening. You weren't just looking.
I didn't. This was a big move. I didn't think I had the kind of game to step to a woman as beautiful as Jordan. And so I don't know where I got the moxie, but I stepped up and I was persistent. And I imagine she was well courted, and she was beautiful and nice and sincere and engaging. And
but you pulled out all the stops. You're calling up Mario for the late night at the upstairs at Babbo, the imaginary floor, and all of that stuff.
Jean-George seating us at on our like fourth date and cooking our dinner and like really, that was, thank you, Wiley, that was you. All the stops. You know, I invited her to like travel and do all this crazy stuff, and she moved to Colorado. So we had a 2-year kind of sabbatical. I didn't see her for a couple of years. We kept in touch, but then she went to cooking school and she needed to do her internship or externship, whatever. I don't actually know the difference between those things. And I helped her with some connections at Restaurant Danielle and Gramercy and La Bernardin, a few places where I knew the chefs. And she really liked working at Danielle. So she was a cook at Danielle, and where you got to know her, I believe you worked together at that time.
She was nice enough to say hello.
As a kind of stagiaire in the kitchen at Danielle, you probably, that's a big commitment of time, just saying hello, because you're in the weeds the whole day. And she worked, we got to get to know each other a little bit. Then she made the transition to the front of the house and picked my brain, had a million questions, and it was great. And she...
And you could mentor somebody. You could bring somebody along. You could help someone's career.
Yeah, and at the time, I didn't know what it would turn into. It's hard to, at the time, for me to envision where Jordan is today. At that time, would it, not inconceivable, but you know, I knew she was driven. I knew she was intelligent. And she had a lot of passion. But how that unfolds in such a quick time, it's amazing to me. How you go from being kind of a stagiaire cook to a wine director in a number of years in New York is one of the great things about our business, right? She is very, very, very impressive. Very impressive.
So you get married, and did that start a new chapter for you?
It did start a new chapter. We got married in August 30th, 2008, sadly 2 weeks before the world economic crisis.
Which had a big effect on you.
Had a big effect on us. You know, our check average at Crew is, I don't know, $250, $280 a person.
How much did you spend on a honeymoon?
We spent a lot of money on our wedding. We had, you know, the world was, you know, it got bigger and bigger and frothier. You know, we thought the end could never come, but it did. And and it definitely changed our dynamics at Crew. Our, you know, spending money on fancy wine was very out of fashion.
Not just people didn't want to do it, it was morally out of fashion.
More that there was approbation. You would be looked down upon. People who were bulletproof had billions of dollars. Yeah, sure, they lost some money. They were bulletproof. We're drinking $100 bottles of wine, which, you know, a month before would be drinking a $2,000 bottle of wine, simply because they didn't want to be seen living it up. Because, you know, there's a lot of intertwined businesses. If you're a hedge fund manager taking care of all these people's money and you're fine, but all these people lost all their fortunes and you're drinking a $2,000 bottle of wine in public, it's a bad sign.
And the Madoff thing had just happened.
And that was the death knell. That really crushed people's spirit more than anything. And what was the next thing that was going to happen?
People thought there was going to be more Madoffs down the line.
Yeah.
Banks were going to close, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it was crazy.
I mean, banks did close, right?
Banks did close, yeah. And the financial industry likes to drink wine at fancy restaurants, as we all know. And when that became taboo, you know, we suffered, for sure. And Roy, to his credit, you know, lost a bunch of money keeping the restaurant open at a high level. No one got fired. We didn't reduce staff. We didn't reduce payroll. We bought a lot of wine in the fall of 2008, actually. A lot, because the prices went to nothing. And but for a year of that not rebounding, it takes a toll. And I end up leaving Crew a little over a year later to, which was tough, really hard. But I mean,
that was probably the toughest thing that had happened to you in your career. First huge setback, right?
It was a huge setback. It was my choice, but I knew I had to do something because it was a top heavy company. We had a lot of big salaries, we had a lot of talent. Raj Veda left to go work at Danielle. Michel Kourou was still there. He would then leave to go to Per Se. I left to go work for Tom Colicchio and his restaurant group and did that for a little while. While talking to Ryan Hardy about opening a restaurant in New York.
And you had met him in Colorado.
I'd met him in Colorado. He was a champ for our wedding. He had a farm outside of Aspen where he asked Jordan what kind of vegetables would she want grown specifically for our wedding dinner. And so Ryan was, he did all of the raw and crudo and raw bar and all this crazy food at our wedding and couldn't have been cooler about it. And Jordan and I, as a thank you, got him dinner at Alinea because he'd said he had never been. And he turned it into, well, let's make it a double date. And so we went, four of us had dinner in Chicago. And so it was the first time we were over dinner at Alinea. Did he talk about wanting to move from Aspen and how the town was getting too small and how he really wanted to kind of spread his wings? And he was talking about San Francisco. It's kind of inevitably, I'm going to go to San Francisco or I'm going to go to New York. I hear this all the time from wine people or chefs in other cities. I'm going to San Francisco, I'm going to New York. And so, well, if you want to come to New York, let me know. We'll figure something out. And I don't know, 2 years later or something, he said, all right, I'm moving. And I was still working at Colicchio. And it took us a while. It took us over a year to find a space. It's hard, you know. Economics of opening a restaurant are really tough. Everyone knows that, especially in New York. And finding the right rent, the right deal was tough. But we found it. We were really, really fortunate to find Charlie Bird. And that's been a blast, Charlie Bird. A real, you know, it's... People, I have this other business where it's like wine consulting. I do all this like cool, fun travel shit with, you know, wealthy guys. And my friends were like, why would you want to go back into the restaurant business?
I think a lot of people ask you that.
A lot. And I don't think it made sense. And when I would say, because I really love being in the restaurant. I really love serving wine. I really want to be tableside. People thought it was a line.
That's a nice thing to say. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's going to look good in the headline.
Right, it's marketing. But it is true. And however much I like drinking Sauvignon Latache, I also want to know, what is 2013 like in Liguria?
But it's also like, if you're sitting at home, there's no party, right?
Right.
Like, restaurants bring the party to you.
Yeah, it's great.
It's happening, you know?
Oh, it's so much fun. I it'd be hard to believe that I won't be somehow involved in restaurants forever. I just love being in the restaurant. I like talking to guests. I like welcoming people in. Actually, I like passing along the information that's been given to me by really smart students of hospitality.
But I also think you like blowing it up a little bit. You're like, oh, well, here's a level. Let's increase it a couple and we're going to put it in front of you. I mean, that's part of the thing.
I have to say, I have strong opinions. I think that there are right ways to do things. And I think there are a lot of places that do it wrong. And so to have a spot where you can say, all right, this is what I believe. You can disagree. That's fine. But I'm putting my money where my mouth is. I'm not just saying glassware is important or wine service temperature is important or tasting wine before serving it is important or having a well-priced wine list is important or being friendly and nice and engaging and not snobby and are important values, or that the person at the front door shouldn't just be like typing away at the screen telling you that you can't sit for 3 hours without even engaging you. You can have those beliefs, but if you don't activate them...
You're just like the angry guy in the street. Yeah, like, exactly. You people doing it all wrong. If I did it, it would be different.
And Charlie Bird's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but it's definitely a reflection of what I value and what Ryan values. And we thought that...
Seems to have been successful. No, I mean, people come to this restaurant
much more than we had anticipated, to be honest. And I think people in all areas respond to authenticity. And I think Charlie Bird is authentic because it may not be the most fashionable, it may not be the most cutting edge, but it's authentic. It really reflects our values. And when we're there, we're talking to the staff, we're talking to our wine team, we're talking to the cooks. it's coming from a place of real passion and real belief that we think you should treat people well because it's important.
But what happened to the wise ass Robert that, you know, used to be around? I mean, how did you fit that into the I mean, how do you think you fit it in? Let me ask you that question.
It comes out, your personality comes out when you're at tables. And I heard this, and I wish I knew who coined this phrase, but I heard it and I kind of adopted it as my own, in that celebrities like to be treated like regular people, and regular people like to be treated like celebrities. So, you know, Phil, wealthy person for celebrity, it's kind of the same thing, right? And so when I'm around, I'm fortunate that I have a lot of access to people with, you know, a lot of opportunities.
I mean, right, Robert? I mean, that seems like you've redefined that as a sommelier thing, as possible. More than anyone in the history of wine, Robert, since the medieval times. I mean, come on.
No,
really.
I think people respond to authenticity. People know that I really like what I do, and I really care, and I really, really do love the wines I'm talking about, whether I have a financial stake in it or not. I make no money by saying, you should really love Russo. No shit. But it's great, blah, blah, blah. I have no financial gain in that. So when you're around people who see passion, authenticity, I think it's infective.
But come on, Robert.
What?
You're not answering the question.
Oh, I don't know.
Why are you so successful broing down with private collectors?
I don't know.
When did you realize it was important?
I met a guy named Noam Gottesman in 1999 at Nick and Tony's, and he was a great customer. Over the summer, he lived in London at the time. He had a house in the Hamptons, and in summer of 2001, he asked me to come over for lunch, and it was because I'd served him wine every time he came in and loved it, and I always turned him on to something new. First wine I ever served him was Phelps Insignia, 1977. Next wine was like 85 Giacosa Red Label. It's like the late 90s. He never heard of it. He never heard of Phelps. He never heard of Isley. He never heard of any of these things. And Jeff Salloway at Nick Notice had one-off bottles here and there that I could just take and open them whatever I wanted for the right customer. And one guest had given me a bottle of 1993 Dalavala Cabernet as a gift, as a thank you for whatever. Next time Noam came in with his wife, he said, you know, I'd like to drink whatever you think. And I gave him the bottle of 1993 Dalavale. I think they were really good back then. And I gave it to him as a gift because he had always been generous with me. And he said, no, you have to charge me for the wine. I said, I can't charge you for the wine because it was a gift to me. I can't make money off of it. You've been always so generous. And I just wanted to pay you back. He said, what are you doing for lunch tomorrow? And I said, nothing. But I had been invited to a bunch of rich guys' houses for lunch. And I was always like, this guy's different. But he's a rich guy, and I'm going to go to lunch, and I'm going to have to tell him how important his wine cellar
right.
is. And
how great he is.
And yeah.
Admire things. That's nice. Like, yeah. That's also nice.
Well, great. And that's kind of boring, quite frankly. Everyone who like reads Wine Spectator and buys the top wines and puts them in the wine cellar and then tells you what a smart buyer they are because they bought 97 Brunello di Montalcino. You've got to be impressed by that. I'm not impressed by that. So anyway, go to his house. It is perfectly understated. Everything about it's beautiful. There's nothing garish or, there's no McMansion. It's got really elegant taste. Go to his wine cellar. It just has Bordeaux in it. And he says, this is all we drink in London, which is why when I come in, I want to drink Italian or American because I would love for you to help me fill this with wines that like the wines you've served me at Nick and Tony's. And I thought, oh, okay. A month later, our world kind of ends, right? It's September 11th. I lose my job at Danielle because they close for lunch. I have nothing kind of lined up because I was doing this kind of short-term thing at 71 Clinton. The wine guy comes back. I have no job. And so I spend all of my time building Noam's wine cellar. He gives me $50,000. He's like, he wires me 50 grand. He goes, go to auction, buy some wine. Now the wine, wine auctions is
full of stuff.
Full of stuff back then. October 2001. Oof. So I bought $75,000 worth of wine. And I sent him an email. I said, I'm sorry, the wine dealers were so good. The opportunity was so good, I couldn't turn it down. I need $25,000 more. And wires it. No questions asked. He hasn't seen a single bottle. He doesn't really know me at all. Comes November for Thanksgiving back to the Hamptons. Goes in the wine cellar, and it's I had a handmade leather portfolio, like really understated, printed out like a wine list with bin numbers and the whole thing. And his friend, who really loves wine, comes over. He goes, "Wow, you actually now have a real serious wine cellar. What happened?" He goes, "Oh, I met this guy and blah blah blah." Calls me on Thanksgiving. He says, "I just want to thank you. You put together an unbelievable thing for me. I'm really grateful." I said, "Oh, it's great." And he said, "How do I pay you?" And I said, "I don't know. I never thought of it." And he said, "Typically what I do is I just, you know, my art guys get some percentage. My furniture guys get some percentage. I'll just give you a percentage of the thing." And I thought, that doesn't seem fair. The day I spent wine, you know, I bought $50,000 wine auction. I didn't earn $5,000 that day. I said, "Why don't we do this? How about I determine what my time is worth and you can just pay me for that time?" And he said, and it was maybe a quarter of what he would have given me if it had been a percentage. And he said, "I don't really think that that's fair to you." I said, "No, I think it's actually pretty right on." You know, I'd never made a lot of money. So to make like $1,500 was like real money, you know? And so that was the first time I started with a client, and he told everybody that he knew about it. So he would fly me over to London, introduce me to his wine friends or his hedge fund guys, and they would have me build wine cellars for them. And they would say, "Just tell me what I have in here that's not good, and what should I buy, and what should I not buy?" And 27 years old, like, what? I'm like, the craziest thing. I'm in these $50 million homes with $1 million of junk in the wine cellar. And I'm like, "You just give all this to your staff and I'll send you 10 cases of wine." And I don't know how it happened. It just happened. And word got around, And he kept introducing me to these people. And it got to be so big that I had to take on two partners and start a wine consulting actual company. And, you know, this was around the time when La Palais was coming into New York and a lot of people were being introduced to these wines for the first time. And there was a lot of interest in Burgundy after, you know, in the early 2000s, not like it is now, but it started to catch fire a little bit. But you could still buy, you know, we bought Jaillet for nothing, relatively. A case for what a bottle's worth now. And we bought cases of Sauvignon Latache. We bought, this is the parcel we bought, five cases that they were $1,300 a bottle. Now it's $6,000. So, you know, in any case, so at the time, there was still an opportunity to buy really, really great world-class blue chip wine for not a big number, right? You know, especially in relation to what 2000 Bordeaux futures were trading for. And you'd be like, "Really, you can drink young Bordeaux for the same price as 71 Latache? Like, really? That's kind of an easy one for me." So I think there were a lot of people looking at the market that way and the inefficiency of the market. When I would explain the inefficiency of the wine market to these really smart financial bankers, they actually, I think they thought I was lying. Because they're like, nothing is this inefficient. And it was. And now it's much less inefficient, obviously. But we bought a lot of wine.
What's next for Robert the Conqueror? I mean, what's the next?
You know, I have to say, I like kind of doing what I'm doing right now. I really like working with Grant and Arvid at Charlie Bird. And we have on the wine team, and we started our own business, actually a kind of a spin-off of that wine consulting company that I started in the back with Dave Beckwith, who's like born to be a consultant. The guy's like perfect for that job. So he has a bunch of clients, and we spun off and just kept a small group of guys. So Grant, Arvin, and I both work at Charlie Bird and in our own company. So we kind of keep that small, really only five clients that we work with. And we're going to open another restaurant in Nolita. But I would like to continue to have to work with people I'm really really inspired by, guys like Ryan and Arvid and Grant, and we just brought Daniel Brookstead from Pizzeria Locale in Boulder, another Bobby Stuckey disciple. So if I can continue to do that, I'd be happy. And, you know, the near future is fatherhood, and that'll be probably even more terrifying than opening a New York City restaurant.
Have you told your grandfather that he's going to be a great-grandfather?
Yeah.
Robert Boer is about to be a father. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you very much for having me, Levy. I really appreciate it.
Episode 300 with Robert Boer of Charlie Bird and Grand Cru Selections.
Recently, a regular listener of the show reached out to me and asked why didn't I have a wine club that they could get regular shipments of wines that we picked for the show to be shipped to them. That's something that we'd be happy to arrange with Crush, who's our retail partner. And if you're interested in that as well, simply send me an email at levyopenswine@gmail.com. That's levyopenswine@gmail.com. And let me know that you might also be interested in automatic shipments of wines that we've picked out to go specially with these interviews and also picked out because we really like them. We'll be happy to figure it out with you with Crush. Send me an email at levyopenswine@gmail.com and we can talk further about it. It'll be a simple process to set up and you'll be on your way to drinking a whole lot better or at least more in tune with the show, which is, hey, not that bad of a thing. Thanks for your support. See you in the email. Thanks for listening. You can find us on our website at alldrinktothatpod.com where you can find information about purchasing a t-shirt if you'd like or find back episodes. You can find us on Facebook. We're on Twitter as well at Drink to That Pod. And I'm on Instagram with some wine photos, probably too many wine photos, really. But, you know, if you like wine, maybe you do if you listen to the show. It's Levy Opens Wine with L-E-V-I at the start there. Levy Opens Wine on Instagram. In terms of the show itself, one of the real frustrations that we have is that oftentimes people treat it like a secret. It's like that special restaurant that they really like, that when they go, they like it because they can sit down immediately. Not a lot of people know about it. It's not too crowded. Well, the thing with restaurants like that is a lot of times they close. And the reason they close is because they don't reach enough clientele. And what I would suggest to you is if you like the show, you can help us out a lot by sharing it with your friends or sharing it with your enemies, really. I really don't care. But make your voice heard in support of the show if you like the show. You can do that by sharing a post on Instagram. You can do that by retweeting a tweet. You can do that by leaving a comment in iTunes, which is super helpful, actually, or subscribing to the show on iTunes, which is equally as helpful. They're the kind of things that go a real long way in terms of a small show like this that tries to over-deliver with content and tries to give you the best each week, actually a couple times a week. We could always use more support, frankly, and if you're listening, thank you for doing that. Please take the next step and help introduce other people to the show as well by sharing with your friends or leaving a comment on iTunes so that our ratings go a little bit higher and we can get the word out a little bit better and more people will be drinking better wine in a more informed fashion. We're there for you. Please help us out on the other side. We love you.